go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. As always, we are joined with our super producers. We have a new producer stepping up to the board today, not just a coworker, but our friend, Paul Deckant.
Welcome, Paul.
Yep. And luckily, and now I don't know, Paul, did you drive here today or did you walk? He walked. Paul walked.
Yeah, and he lives very, very close. It would be very close. Absurd for him to have a car, I think, to bring it to work.
And
that close.
And you drove today.
I did drive, yes.
And often, I think the majority of people in Atlanta and in other cities across the United States typically will drive not only to work but to their friend's house, to their sports games, to their, like, kids' graduation.
Sure. You need a car.
You need a car in most parts of the U.S.
Yeah. Now, I have to ask you that same question. You've recently moved.
I did, yeah.
But not very far.
No, so, I moved down the street.
So do you still walk to work, or do you now, take the car even though it's a short distance?
I like to walk to work because the street that we're on is a pretty entertaining street. It's nice to get a little bit of exercise, but if I have some errands to run or if I'm leaving on a road trip after we get out of the old 9-to-5, then I'll just take my car up here and then leave straight from work.
Oh, smart move.
It's all right. I got some moves. I got a few. But
I guess we should consider ourselves among the lucky if we're in the southeastern United States.
Yeah.
And if we were any further south, there might be a little trouble with trying to get around in our cars because a lot of cars were flood damaged, not only by – well, in our case, it would have been by Hurricane Irma.
Mm-hmm.
If you were a little bit further west on the coast – the Gulf of Mexico coast in Texas, it would have been Hurricane Harvey. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
Right. We're recording this in 2017, right at the beginning of fall, end of summer, where – and at this point in time, as we're recording, quite a few cities, communities, towns were devastated by either Harvey or Irma.
Still digging out or bailing out, if you want to put it that way, really. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of cars, and we'll talk about that in a second. But right here in Atlanta, we had a tropical storm issued, and that was the first time ever, or was it an actual hurricane warning?
It was a tropical storm warning, and it was the first issued in the history of Atlanta.
Yeah, it was pretty strong. I mean, I was at home during that time, and, lots of branches down and rain, but no flooding. And we're far enough north, away from the coast, away from the water, that really we get the wind, we get the rain, we get power outages, we get some light damage, things like that. I shouldn't say light damage because there were some people that had some serious tree damage here in town and even a couple of deaths in Atlanta from falling trees.
Right. I believe four, is that correct?
Yeah, I think it was three or four. I think it was four. Mm-hmm. So it's still, the winds were still a big deal around here, but nothing at all like what Florida saw, the panhandle of Florida. And then it kind of moved even a little bit west of Atlanta. So it didn't really hit the coast of Georgia like we thought it was going to, but they got winds and rain and all that stuff. And, in Florida, they had a significant amount of flooding, and I'll tell you, this is as soon after we're recording this. This is the very week that it hit us.
Right.
And, a lot of the reports we're reading are saying, that it's still technically ongoing. The storm hasn't completely fizzled out yet.
Right.
It's still headed north and west. And, Harvey, they're kind of in wrap-up mode there. They got some totals, semi. Calculated, I guess, at this point.
They have ballpark estimates, but still, this is very early day stuff at this point. Scott, I have an interesting story that you might enjoy that brought me to this episode we're recording today.
Okay, what's that?
All right, so Monday, when the storm hit in Atlanta, a lot of buildings were closed. A lot of people were told to stay home. The previous day, Sunday night, I had taken my car and put it in the parking deck here because there are a lot of old, large hardwood trees around where I live.
Oh, yeah. And watch out for that.
Yeah, my spider sense was telling me it could get ugly.
Yeah.
So I parked the car on Sunday night. We lost power on Monday, and I said, it can't be that bad outside. I've got an umbrella. I've got a decent jacket.
Oh, boy.
And so I went exploring.
Yeah.
Did I tell you this off air?
No, you have not, but I know what the winds were like. They were gusting up to, I think it was 70 miles an hour.
It was astonishing, the force, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And especially
how your umbrella fare.
Oh, the umbrella's gone, buddy. The umbrella is gone. It did just like you see in the old slapstick films yeah. where it reversed.
Yeah.
And then
left your hand.
I did put it in a trash can but I could have just let it go.
Yeah. Sure.
But I didn't want to add to the problem. But as I was walking down our city streets and seeing everything closed except for, I think, one Chinese restaurant, and power out all over the place, I noticed that there were a lot of cars just sitting mm-hmm. willy-nilly. And Atlanta had a temporary problem with high wind and falling branches at that time, right? And mm-hmm. a lot of cars got crushed in the metro area.
Sure.
But Atlanta also has a historic problem with flooding.
Yeah, you're right. And well, we didn't have a lot of flooding here though at this time.
No.
So we just didn't get enough rain, I guess.
No, mainly
again,
wind.
Trees down. It's funny, Atlanta, you wouldn't guess it, but Atlanta is almost, I've heard it described as a city in a forest.
Right.
There are a lot of green trees here. If you're from another large city, you might not understand exactly what that's like until you drive through Atlanta. Like you said, there are a lot of large hardwood trees that, I mean, you know, big enough around that if two people were to join arms, you know, that's how big the base of the trees would be in some cases. And believe it or not, some of those, you know, they get soaked with lots of rain and those tip right over like they're nothing. And they crush houses and cars and people and all kinds of horrible things. So you were smart to move your car out of the way. Now the flooding affected Texas and Florida a lot worse than it did here in Georgia. Now, in Texas, I've heard estimates around 500,000 to 600,000 cars and trucks were flooded or considered flood out cars. Damaged.
Total loss.
Yeah, total loss. Hurricane Irma, we don't yet know what the total is amount is there, but they're expecting roughly the same, maybe on a lower end on that one. So maybe, 400 to 500,000 are the numbers that I've seen thrown around. Not sure if that's going to, you know, prove to be true or not, but we're talking about between the two hurricanes, and those hit within a week of each other, it's a couple weeks of each other, about 1 million cars and trucks that are potentially on the used car market as flood vehicles. Now, potentially on the used car market. Now, this is hoping that people do the right thing.
Right.
If they're insured, they're going to be reported as damaged, you know, flood damaged, and the right thing is going to happen. And we'll talk about what happens with an insured vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
If they're uninsured, there's a good chance that car will be cleaned up and someone will attempt to put that on the used car market, either here in the United States, possibly in Mexico, might go all the way down as far as, Central America.
Sure.
Even South America. It happened with Katrina. It's happened in other hurricane situations mm-hmm. where flood damaged vehicles have made their way to other countries. And sometimes people know what they're getting. Sometimes people know they're buying a flooded vehicle.
And just want a chance.
A salvage title vehicle. And they do want to, they want to take that chance, roll the dice, I guess, and see what they get. But, I read an article in Automotive News before we get into our main, focus here, because there's something a little bit diabolical happening in Texas right now. And we want to get to that. But mm-hmm. first, I want to tell you that I've read an article in Automotive News just this morning about Mexico and how they're bracing for the possibility of flood damaged cars making their way across the border. Mexico City, especially, because I think it was after Katrina, they said thousands, if not tens of thousands of used vehicles that were damaged in Katrina made their way into Mexico City. And then, of course, were dispersed from there throughout the rest of the country. So you can see that this is a big deal for all the regions surrounding, Texas and not just, not just really, really localized either. I mean, this is far reaching. This could go up to Maine. This could go up to, all the way up to the far northeast corner of the United States. It could be anywhere, really. Mexico, again, Central America. It happens. And we'll tell you later what to watch out for. But Ben, we do really have to talk about what's going on in Texas and some of the scammers that are hitting the people that have been ravaged by this hurricane.
Yeah, absolutely. So, similar to the situation with Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans earlier, Hurricane Harvey has, as we said, devastated the Houston area, and with these gigantic natural disasters, one unfortunate thing that always happens is the fraudsters get in there early.
And we're not talking about looters. We're not talking about car thieves.
No.
We're not talking about insurance scams. Not really. We are talking about tow truck and wrecker services that are doing a real disservice to their community in some cases. Now, not all. Now, we have to point that out, too.
It's a bad apple situation.
That's exactly right. As we've said so many times in this program, there's just a few that are causing a lot of problems. A few characters, as we'll find out, that are really, really causing some troubles down there.
And here's what's happening. So, in the wake of Harvey, there are hundreds of thousands of abandoned vehicles left in the Houston area and the surrounding, you know, the surrounding communities. Mm-hmm. Wreckers have started kidnapping some vehicles, according to the Insurance Council of Texas and their spokesman, Mark Hanna.
Yeah.
Hanna is saying that some wreckers, who he does go out of his way to characterize as a small number of people, have been pulling vehicles from the water and then charging owners as much as $4,000 to $5,000 to get their cars back.
So they're kidnapping cars and holding them for ransom.
They're non-consensually pulling them. It's like if you parked in a legal space,
yeah,
and someone towed your car,
yeah,
and said, "Scott, you can have your VW back for the low price of $4,000."
Yeah, what are you going to do?
I mean, it's pretty much car theft.
Yeah, it really is.
It's Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah, and he says, you know, the guy, what's his name, Hannah, was saying that they're telling people if they do use a wrecker service, make sure that they use caution whenever they're asked to sign anything, because, just read the small print. There could be in there, you know, this $4,000 or $5,000 fee. So, you know, aside from the ones that are just grabbing cars off the road and taking them back to their impound lot, there's also people that are willingly signing their vehicles over to somebody, saying, "Yeah, it's out there. I can see it in the middle of that lake that used to be Main Street. You know, now, you know, pull it back in." And they say, "Fine, we'll do it." And they bring it back. And then, of course, there's, you know, all these fees. They add up. I think it's administrative fees, and they make up a lot of different bogus fees,
quote unquote.
Yeah, in order to make this equal, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 per vehicle. Now, we should point out too, this is an article from Car and Driver. A guy named David Mueller wrote this, and this is back in it was on September 1st, I think, when officially the hurricane in Texas wasn't even over really until about September 3rd. So this is the early days of the hurricane. I'm hoping that they stop this from happening, but I have a feeling there's still little isolated pockets
of these
car kidnappers.
Are you kidding? Supply and demand, my friend, because there's already this tremendous shortage, this dearth of tow truck vehicles or tow trucks, and then tow truck drivers or pilots. And
there's 125 counties.
Right.
That are
exactly
affected.
Hannah's office said that because of the massive amount of vehicles and the huge number of owners who are praying for any tow truck, which is in short supply.
Yeah.
These guys are able to pull this scam. Earlier in the month, they said that there were about 100,000 car and truck owners who had already submitted insurance claims for flood damaged vehicles. Of those, 75% will likely be totaled. And I think that's a conservative estimate, if I'm being honest.
Oh, it probably is. And the thing is, that's the rush right there. It's not so much that people want to get the stuff back that's in their car, because it's likely nothing, you know, nothing that's worth any value at this point, that's been in a flooded vehicle for a week or a week and a half or whatever at this point. The rush is to be able to get that insurance paperwork kind of turned around and in progress so that you can get a new vehicle, because these people will be stuck without a vehicle for who knows how long until that check arrives, if they're not in a position to just go out and outright buy another vehicle from a dry region.
Mm-hmm. And this is only the beginning. I'll give just to further emphasize the demand for tow truck drivers here.
Mm-hmm.
A place called the Insurance Auto Auctions Incorporated, or IAA, which is a unit of a larger auction service, has already put out the call for over 1,000 out of state tow truck drivers.
Oh, that's interesting, because we usually think of linemen and people to restore power and people. I guess linemen would do that, right? But people to restore power, people with medical training, you know, things like that. We don't think of needing 1,000 extra tow trucks in an area, really.
Right, but Houston is, if anything, even more of a sprawling metro area than Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
So, with that in mind, there's no way the city really functions without personal transport.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Because, again, we're talking about 125 counties mm-hmm. that were flooded. It's not just Houston proper. It's everything surrounding it. But Ben, you know, that's not the end of the story by any means, right? There's a lot more to this. You know, after all the vehicles are pulled out and after all the vehicles are in their proper place, you know, whether that's in a salvage lot or whether it's, you know, in a scrapyard or something, you know, whatever, where they're going to be crushed. There's a second wave of trouble that begins, and that is when all of these cars begin to make their way to the used car market, as we said, you know, that Mexico was bracing for.
Right.
And of course, you know, other parts of our country should be bracing for this as well. This is unbelievable. Last year, so a year prior to, you know, these two big flooding events that happened mm-hmm. in the United States, the National Insurance Crime Bureau states that there were probably or likely 271,404 flooded cars that were back in use. So they're back on the roads. Now, I would bet that's a mix of salvage vehicles, cars that people had no idea were in floods. You know, just a big combination of the two, you know, uninsured vehicles that somehow made their way into the market. The insured vehicles hopefully didn't make their way back onto the market, but right. that's a huge number. That's also a very specific number. I wonder how they got exactly that number.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I wonder how much of it is an estimate. And, you know, to be completely honest, that number has probably changed. It's unfortunately likely increased since the time of publication.
Well, the warning here should be that uninsured vehicles are the ones that can be put up, you know, put up for sale eventually with no disclosure of ever having been flood damaged.
So you won't see a flood stamp on the title or salvage or anything like that.
Yeah. Now, this is eye opening. I'm going to give you a handout here that I printed for this specific purpose in a moment here. But, so this is again, the National Insurance Crime Bureau, right? Mm-hmm. They're talking about uninsured vehicles. And you might think, well, how many vehicles in Texas really could be uninsured in these 125 counties just along the coast, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, a spokesman from the ICT, and the ICT is the Insurance Council of Texas. Well, that was Hannah, again, Mark Hannah. He said that about 15% of Texans generally drive without insurance.
What?
15%. So when something like this happens, 15% of those cars that you're seeing in the flooded area, just and on average, are not insured at all. That's just a complete loss. They've lost
terrible.
Everything. So and of the Texas motorists that are insured, this is actually good news, about 75% have comprehensive coverage, which would cover now flood damage. Now, Ben, I'm going to hand you this thing that I printed out here.
Okay. I'm taking this handout.
When I saw that number, 15% of Texans – you haven't seen this before, but
I have not.
When I read that 15% of Texans generally drive without insurance, I thought there is there's no way that many or that large of a percentage would drive without insurance. But it turns out that Texas doesn't even make on this list. I'm gonna share with you doesn't even make the top 11 states with drivers with the least number of uninsured or the most number of uninsured motorists rather.
Wow.
So. This comes from a site called statisticsbrain.com, and the sources are not just from them. It comes from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, or the NAIC, the Insurance Research Council, and the California Department of Insurance. And this is very recent, from August of 2016. So these are good numbers.
Holy smokes.
So here's the deal. I would think that 15% would be high up there. This list, for some reason, instead of giving 10, it gave 11. I'm not sure exactly why. Mm-hmm. We can go down the list if you want, but I don't think we need to read all of them in the percentages.
No.
But starting with the state with the highest percent of uninsured motorists is Oklahoma. 25.9% of motorists in Oklahoma are not insured.
Which means there is a 1 in 4 chance. Oh, there's a more than a 1 in 4 chance that if you are in the interstate anywhere and you are involved in a car accident, you are SOL.
Isn't that unbelievable?
We're a family show, so that acronym is straight out of luck.
Now, the states, again, Texas at 15% doesn't even crack the top 11 here.
That's
now crazy. We'll just list down. I mean, okay, so that's 25.9%. It goes down to 15.9%. So it gets very close to where Texas is, but I have a feeling there's more states ahead of Texas.
Yeah.
All right. So the list, if we just go from 1 to 11.
List of shame.
So the most, like the highest percentage of uninsured motorists is in Oklahoma. Again, 25.9%. The next is Florida, then Mississippi, then New Mexico, Michigan, Tennessee.
Woo, I'm from there.
Tennessee is number six with 20.1% of motorists that are uninsured on the roads. Then it's Alabama, Rhode Island, Colorado, Washington, and then Arkansas is at number 11. I'm not sure why they included Arkansas, but again, at 15.9%.
There's always room for Arkansas, Scott. It's the jello of states.
I just wonder where – and then, you know, of course, there's also – if you go to the site, to statisticsbrain.com, you can find the states with the lowest percentage of uninsured motorists, which is on the good side.
Massachusetts is killing it.
Massachusetts, number one at just 3.9%.
That makes me feel like they caught one guy.
Isn't that something? I mean, can you believe it? 15% in that area. So they're going to face a total loss in this case. You know, they're not going to, unless they decide to keep it. You know, unless they decide to keep their flood damaged vehicle.
Which is a whole nother, can of chinchillas. I'm doing different stuff other than like bags of cats.
Right. You know what? I think maybe this is a good time for a break, you know, a word from our sponsor, because we're going to come back and talk about what happens to the insured vehicle.
And we're back. Before we go on, Scott, I do have to point out that I know insurance can be kind of a yawning session for some people,
yeah. But
it's crucial in these post-disaster times because those states we named that have the highest level of uninsured drivers are probably also very likely in the U.S. to be states with higher than average percentages of flood cars too, you know, or salvage cars, you know, cars bought off some guy named like Fast Eddie at the back of a gas station.
Sure.
Unreliable stuff. This, what we're going to see is that after a hurricane or after, you know, a massive, destructive act of nature, these things don't stay in one area or one state. They proliferate. They spread out.
Oh, they sure do.
And you might be listening and think, well, I live in Portland. Everything's going to be fine. Don't be so sure. Do your due diligence. We'll explore that. Well, but for now, we should talk about what happens if you actually have insurance.
Yeah, you make a fantastic point because there are always catastrophes, floods, things like that happening all over the United States, all over the world. You really have to be diligent about looking for the right signs. Now, we'll tell you about signs and signs later, but
yeah.
Right. Insured vehicles. Now, this is the okay version of, you know, the people that are going to be okay at the end of all this, right?
Hopefully.
The people that, I hope so. I mean, if they have the right type of coverage, I guess the comprehensive coverage, which would cover the flood damage. As we said, 75% of Texans had it in that area, apparently. So the insured vehicles, they're deemed typically in a flood situation, they're deemed as a total loss because, you know, a lot of the electronics are destroyed. Or they were, you know, someone tried to continue to drive in the water, you know, sucked water into the cylinders and, you know, water doesn't compress, you know, that, you know what happens. But typically they're deemed a total loss and they'll be retitled with the Department of Motor Vehicles and the new titles will declare that the cars and trucks have been flood damaged and information about that will be stated in any vehicle history report that will ever come up about the vehicle that is attached to that VIN. That VIN for that engine, that car. That's kind of important to remember that it's attached to that VIN as well. But most of the flood vehicles will likely be parted out with their undamaged components, if there are any, finding new life elsewhere, according to the National Insurance Crime Bureau. So that's good news, right? I mean, if it's not damaged, if it's deemed something that's salvageable, that will find a new life somewhere else. Someone can make use of those sensors, those parts or whatever. But
very circle of life.
It's a bit of a dangerous game to play though, isn't it? That, you know, you can ensure that those sensors haven't been damaged or that part hasn't been damaged. It kind of depends the level. I mean, looking at some of the photos of Houston, some of those cars are up to the roof in water. Those are not salvageable.
And some have been completely submerged for days.
Yeah, you're right. Completely under.
That's something else that we'll touch on in the course of the show today is As cool as it sounds for everything to be reused, if there are components that look functional, or even if, you know what, even if they test well, because these components are typically tested before they're resold or anything.
Sure.
Due to the nature of flood damage, you still can't trust it.
Yeah.
Not to sound paranoid.
No,
but
no.
You still can't trust it because one of the most deceptive types of damage a flood does to a car is wiring and electronic components.
Yeah.
And they can even seem to behave and seem to be pretty cool, right? Like that O2 sensor or whatever is totally, you know, down. I was going to say down to rock, but that doesn't make sense. It's totally functioning.
Yeah. But it's been compromised.
But it has been compromised, and there is unfortunately no silver bullet method for predicting when it's going to break at that point. And mm-hmm. it could be 6 months from now. It could be 6 hours.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And not just the component. Okay. So we were talking about, submerged vehicles right. that have been completely underwater. If it's just a couple of feet, sometimes you can get some of those modules out of that vehicle. If you know
sure.
where the water line is,
right.
It's possible. Mm-hmm. But again, that depends how much time they spent, close to the water, I guess. If it was an inch away from the water surface and there's high humidity, those electronic modules have been compromised in some mm-hmm. way, more than if they were parked in somebody's garage or just, daily use. Now, according again to the NICB, the National Insurance Crime Bureau, some of those flooded vehicles may be purchased at bargain prices, cleaned up, and then taken out of state where the VIN is switched and the car is retitled with no indication
right.
that it has been damaged. Now, that when you're switching a VIN on a vehicle, that's really dirty play. I mean, really dirty play.
Yeah, it's a crime.
It is. I mean, it's a crime, and it's also a crime. I think it's a crime too if it was an uninsured vehicle that you just don't report the damage. You clean the vehicle up, you sell it. I still think that's a crime. I think that you need to report that because the trouble that ensues from that.
Right.
I don't think I could ever have a clear enough conscience. I guess that's the way to say it, right? I wouldn't have a clear conscience after I sold a vehicle like that to somebody.
You couldn't sleep at night?
No, I couldn't. But I mean, I guess an auction house that specializes in salvage vehicles, that's what they do. But people know in that case that it is a salvage vehicle.
Sure. And a lot of times they're buying them just for parts anyway.
Yeah, sure.
And this is sort of a case by case thing, but in our opinion, and I think I speak for both of us here, you should just not mess with salvage titles or flood damaged cars because again, you don't know what you're getting. Look, Scott's right. There are people who will, to turn a quick profit, they will absolutely try to tart up the car externally. You know what I mean? They'll try to get rid of water stains and mildew, but that smell is pretty tough to get out.
It'll go as far as replacing seats, things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, they'll reupholster stuff.
Yeah.
But you can, we have a podcast, that you and I did a while ago, Scott, on, 10 signs of a flood damaged car. Mm-hmm. So we recommend, regardless where you are in the U.S., or in Mexico or wherever you're listening to this.
Worldwide.
I mean, I doubt somebody would ship flood damaged cars across the Pacific, but I don't know, man.
But floods happen across the Pacific.
That's true.
Yeah. So we're not just talking about just this event. That's the thing everybody has to remember is that, that flood that happened in your region, no matter where it is in the world, if it happened last summer, watch out for those cars right now. Or whenever it is. I mean, if it's a month ago, watch out for those cars. And especially if you're someone who goes to auction.
Yeah. And that's, and also you should, if it's your first time going to an auto auction, do not go there planning to buy a car. Plan to go there to watch what happens and learn the ropes first.
Go a few times and learn the ropes.
Yeah.
Talk to some of the old timers there. Hey, we had a lot of good advice in that podcast it was 10 ways to spot a flood damaged car.
Uh-huh.
And that was back in May of 2014. If people want to go to, carstuffshow.com and check that out, you can search for it. It'll come right up.
Wow. You worked that plug-in so well, man. I almost feel bad for pointing it out. That was great.
Oh, you're welcome. I'll try to do that a few times throughout this podcast.
I wanted to add the reason, especially if you're in the U.S., or especially if you're in the region of the U.S. near Houston, Texas, the reason this is so important is because if you are looking for a car in the next few months, you need to be even more diligent than you would have already been. And I know everybody already knows the rules of buying a used car and investigating to the nth degree, which is a great use of your time. but be even more careful. If you're doing 100%, please do 115%.
Yeah, here's three especially important things that you can do. First, vehicle history report.
Absolutely.
Okay, and then after you do that, then check for a salvage title, or maybe even first check for a salvage title if you want to do that. Then go for the vehicle history report. And then there's another place that I want you to go. You can, of course, you know, Carfax and all that. That's usually, you know, that's okay. You can get, you know, some bump and dent work,
right,
know, information from that, but, or maybe even a bent frame information.
It's
that
not
kind of
like
stuff.
Super in depth.
No, not really. Not really. It won't always catch everything. But you can go to something called the NICB's VIN check system. If you go to NICB.org and you look under theft and fraud awareness tab, the theft and fraud awareness tab, you'll see something called VIN check. You can submit the VIN and just find out the vehicle history. It goes a little bit more in depth. It covers salvage records for its, for insurance companies, and it reports, or represents rather, about 88% of the auto insurance market. So it's fairly complete. Again, not 100% complete. So, you know, if there's this little bit of doubt, if you have just a tiny little bit of doubt when you're buying a used car about, its history, its past history, by the way, that is a huge red flag anyways. If you're questioning a vehicle's history, there's probably a reason. If you have a gut feeling about it, you know, follow that gut. But there are some things that potential buyers can check for, if you do suspect that maybe it was a flood damaged car, you want to clarify that little bit of, undocumented history. Check things like, water stains and mildew, or maybe even for silt under the doormats, or even beneath the headliner. Now, if you can find silt underneath the headliner, that obviously that vehicle's been underwater. Mm-hmm. Also check behind the dashboard. If you find that the interior is fading, and door panels as well, top of the dash, that's understandable, I guess, especially
sure,
in a region like Texas.
Sun damage.
Yeah, but if you find that the door panels are starting to fade as well, that's not really the typical. Look for rusted screws in the console or other areas where water would normally not accumulate. You know, if it's places that shouldn't be rusted, if they're rusted,
right,
you should really question that. I mean, I know that, it's humid here in the Southeast, but it's not that humid. Typically those things will be okay, especially on newer vehicles. Also check to see if there's mildew or grime in the seatbelt retractors. That's one area that we specifically called out, I remember,
yeah,
in the flood damage car, because it's one that everybody forgets to clean.
Right. And so it's a really, not to sound too forensic about it, but it's a really great way to figure out what's actually going on in a car. Even if a car has absolutely no suspicion of flood damage, those things are so rarely cleaned that you can tell what kind of snacks people eat.
And
Isn't that gross?
Oh, it is gross. And it's a pretty simple thing to do. And it's as simple as just pulling the seatbelt completely out as far as it'll go. A lot of times people will only clean the seatbelt as far as it, it's required to pull out,
right,
to cover their own body. So, pull it all the way out and check it out and look down inside there with a flashlight if you have to. But, again, check out the seatbelt retractors. That's usually a good sign.
Fogged lights. That's mm-hmm. one of, to me, that's a really good one because somebody can assiduously clean even unto the seatbelt retractors. But they can't really fix those windows, especially if you see a fogged instrument panel.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about
then,
now.
Then, yeah, game over.
Yeah, the gauge cluster is fogged up. Yeah, that means there's dampness inside the dash.
Uh-huh. That's bad.
Oh, and you talked about lights. Now, that could be a crack in the lens, of course.
That could be,
But if you don't see a crack in the lens and yet all the taillights and the headlights are all fogged up, that is a bad sign. Of course, look for new upholstery or carpeting that doesn't seem to match the vehicle. Again, they'll go so far as to replace seats in vehicles, and
right,
of course, uses the shop vacs on the ceilings and the headliners, just all over. So there's some really smart things you can do, and again, we outlined a lot of them in our podcast,
I think.
So if you go back and listen to that one, you'll be fine. But that's just kind of a starting point, really.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to make everybody so paranoid about used cars in this area, but
I don't. Be paranoid.
Well, it's true. You really should. You should be, but I think we're going to see a lot of these turning up. We're going to see news stories in the next several months, I think, of, auction houses that are selling the cars that were formerly uninsured that, either just were never reported or cleaned
right
up and sold and then, give the new owners a lot of trouble.
And this is
– or the VIN change thing.
Yeah, and this is more than just petty fraudster crime, and it's more than just an inconvenience to someone buying a formerly drowned lemon, because this stuff can have physically dangerous consequences on the road. And Scott, speaking of fantastic segues, we'll be back after a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. And Ben, we were continuing our talk about flood cars, but
oh man,
I think we've probably covered, you know, the scammers. We've covered maybe what to look for when, you know, buying a used car in this area, or really anywhere. Let's say anywhere.
And we did say that the scamming tow drivers are, again, just a very small segment of the population. Personally, we'd like to thank all the tow drivers out there who are busting their humps to rescue these cars, as well as the people working the electric lines.
Yeah, night and day.
Night and day.
I mean, everybody's pitching in. Everybody's doing a fantastic job of getting the getting everything cleaned up as fast as possible. So yeah, we do appreciate the help that they're providing. And again, bad apples. Just a couple of bad apples that are. You know, forcing stories like this, but people have to be aware of stuff like that because that's important. So hopefully someone in that area is listening to this and will benefit from this and say, oh, geez, I was nearly nailed for a $5,000 towing bill.
And yeah.
Hopefully it weren't.
Oh my gosh. I think you can, if you don't sign anything, I think you have a case you can make too, but it's tough to ask people to do that in a crisis situation.
All right, Ben.
Yes.
What if somebody decided that after the flood, after their car was, the one on Main Street there with the water all the way up to the headliner.
Oh yeah, the Camry. Yeah. What,
one of about 10,000 Camrys, right?
Right.
If it was the Camry, yeah, the silver one. If they decided that they wanted to save that car, you know, that's a car that I brought my daughter home from the hospital in. I can't part with that. I mean, flood or not, you know, Hurricane Harvey or not. That car means something to me. I got to keep that. I got to keep that 2004 Camry.
Take it out of my cold dead hands. All right. Okay.
So can they do it?
Yeah. That's a very interesting question. I have a feeling you might have some answers or guidance.
Well, okay. Maybe I just gave you a bad example because I'm going to start off with a couple of disclaimers.
Because I would say no.
Yeah. The answer in that case, I just gave you a terrible example.
I would say,
but the answer is no to that. Now, the real answer to this comes from an article that was written by a guy at Jalopnik, David Tracy, and he wrote this just a couple of days ago, September 6th. 2017. So, you know, after Harvey had hit, but not before Irma.
Oh, okay. Yes,
So somewhere in between. His answer is very simple, though. And really, it boils down to this. Off-roaders do it all the time. Think about the Jeep vehicles that you see going through extremely deep, mud puddles, water, crossing rivers, that type of thing. Off-roaders do it all the time. But there's a couple of things that we have to pay attention to, and these are really, really important. And it doesn't apply to every vehicle. So, you know, the Camry that I gave you as an example is a bad example because there's a lot of electronics on board, right? We'll talk about that in a second. But,
sure.
And this also applies to freshwater only. So if you ever have a car or truck that's been flooded by salt water, it's just complete junk.
You should just
get rid of it. Salt water is a different game.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's like – of course, that would be brackish water, I guess, that ended up in the Houston area because right on the Gulf. But it was also – what was it? Trillions of gallons of rain that they said flooded that area.
Probably diluted the salt content.
Probably, yeah. So brackish water, right?
Okay.
That's what they call it.
Yeah,
I think that's it.
No, you're right. You're right.
All right. So his point, David's point is that – you know, there are hundreds of thousands of cars that, you know, had these trillions of gallons of rain on them, or, you know, that flooded them to different levels. You know, some up to maybe a foot or two.
Sure.
Others right to the top. Some are completely submerged. But if you're lucky, there's a few things that you can do to save your car. If you're one of the ones that, flooded 1 or 2 feet and you weren't trying to start the car, you didn't run the car while, you know, the water was up as high as it was.
Right.
There's a chance that you can save that vehicle. Now, I don't know if we should really go too in-depth here because it's a long article. It really does have a lot of information, but this is essentially from a letter that he received that was coming from someone who – I think they had a grandfather who was rebuilding a 56 Ford Victoria and, of course, you know, part of the big Texas flood. And, you know, grandfather – great sentimental value, I guess, to the car. But they didn't want to get rid of it, and they were wondering if they would be able to keep it after the flood because, you know, it was one of these flood-damaged vehicles. He had kind of a long answer, you know, but again, off-roaders do it all the time. I guess David is someone who does a lot of off-roading in Jeep vehicles and says, you know, all the time I'm crossing, you know, 2-3-4 foot, you know, deep mud puddles.
Yeah.
It's possible, but it may be difficult in your situation. So, he goes through in this article, if you want to check it out, what's it called again, Ben?
This is called How to Keep Your Car Running After a Flood.
Yeah, from Jalopnik, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, the sections that he goes through, I mean, he goes through everything, the engine, the transmission, the differential, transfer case, brakes, cooling system, fuel system, interior, and even the electrical system. So
and it looks ugly.
It does. I mean, but, you know, of course, he's got a stripped down vehicle that really doesn't care what it looks like. It's not, you know, a car that he's hoping to maybe take to a show or anything, like maybe, you know, this person's grandfather was with this, 56 Ford. He points out that because this is a 56 Ford, the electrical system might not be as complex as something from the modern era.
That's a great point.
And really, a lot of this boils down to, you know, the electrical components that were damaged. So if, you know, you have sensors that were completely underwater, as you said, Ben, they're compromised.
Yeah.
They are unable to be restored. You have to replace them. And all the wiring that goes along with it. But on a 56 Ford, relatively few wires compared to something as modern as an 04 Camry.
Right.
But if you go through this whole thing, and again, it's several pages. It's really long. We're not going to go through it piece by piece, but he does point to an article at the end. He says, now, if you want to save a flooded car, now, for whatever reason, if there's sentimental values we joked about earlier with the Camry, but some people do have cars like that 56 Ford that they do have, you know, some type of memory attached to or some type of attachment. They just don't want to get rid of it for whatever reason. You have to do a lot of things. You have to ensure that there's no water in your cylinders. You have to keep the fluids decontaminated, you know, by replacing and flushing all that stuff. You have to clean the interior completely, and you have to pray that there were, you know, not in the Ford case, but pray there are not too many sensors and wires that were actually below the water line. There's actually a lot to think about when you're trying to bring a car back from flood damage. And that's not even accounting for corrosion that might occur when water introduces dirt into hard-to-clean parts of the body. So, you know, like you had mentioned before, I think it was a couple of podcasts ago, where you were talking about water in the door of
right.
One of your cars.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't remember which car it was, but mm-hmm. Your uncle, I think it was, or cousin or somebody, right. Figured a way to drain that.
Yes.
And probably saved your door.
Quite possibly, yeah.
Likely. I mean, if it had stayed for too long, it would have rusted out and, you know, rusted right through. That's the same thing that happens with a flood damaged car, is that water is, you know, accumulating in areas that you can't even see, or it's being held in, you know, absorbent material and kept in place. And all that stuff, I mean, it just over even a matter of weeks or months can lead to rust that you just simply can't really come back from without completely rebuilding, replacing that metal.
And there's a further, I'll even take this a step further. There's a further concern, which is that, let's say a car is harboring water from flood damage in Houston, and it is sold, maybe down south, close to the equator where it's even hotter, or even weirder, it's sold up north somewhere where it's colder. And now the water that's already inside cavities or absorbent materials in the interior of the vehicle, now the water is changing due to temperature.
Mm-hmm.
So now the water might be freezing inside. Mm-hmm. It might be evaporating, right? Yeah. It's just bad news all around.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's absolutely bad news. So you don't want any part of that, really. But if you do decide that you have some type of attachment to a specific vehicle, and, you know, it's your grandfather's car,
yeah,
and, you know, it's been in the family for 85 years or whatever, and you feel like you have to hang onto that car, but it was flood damaged, you've got a real dilemma on your hands. What do you do? I mean, do you scrap it? Do you hang on to it and know that it's just going to fall apart in your garage or your driveway? Or do you try to recover from it? Do you try to fix what's wrong with it as quickly as possible? Because that can be a real money pit. That can take a lot. That can take more than it's really worth some cases.
You know, I've seen it happen before. It reminds me of that old Roman Greek story, the ship of Theseus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where somebody they have a ship and it's sailing around the world, and they're slowly replacing and repairing it until one day everything on the ship,
it's brand new.
Yeah. And I know that people sometimes end up in that situation, especially with classic cars, where like, oh, I fully restored this awesome vehicle and it's cherry now, but is it really, or did you just keep the chassis? You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, essentially he bought every new part from a catalog.
So right.
It's a new 56 Chevy or whatever.
With a nice,
it would be.
Yeah. With a vintage shell.
Yeah. I guess a little bit of a resto mod.
Yeah, there we go.
In some sense, right? I mean, even though you tried to keep everything original.
It's just you have to be careful because that can happen if you open that door.
Oh, absolutely. You know? Yeah, yeah. Now, you know, Ben, I think everybody kind of understands that. It's a risk to try to rebuild a flood damaged vehicle. Just let the insurance company have a look at it and let them determine what's going on. In most cases, I would suggest against it. Now, I've got two things that I want to cover here. I actually have three, but I'm going to save one for the next podcast.
Okay, and one of these is a surprise, right?
One is a surprise, and I think the other one – I just want to kind of run this idea past you.
All right.
All right. So
– are we in pitch mode?
This is not the surprise for you at the end that I want to surprise you with. I wanted to know if this would work, and it's something that I read in a forum. It's not my own idea, but it really intrigued me, and I wonder if this would work. So someone had written about, they're questioning all the people that were trying to, you know, put their, precious vehicles, you know, their restored vehicles, their tuned vehicles, whatever, even the family drivers up on blocks or, you know, like I saw people that were trying to put cars that were, you know, up 3-4 feet in the air so that they were out of the floodwaters reach, you know, like as high as they could possibly get them in their garage.
Yeah.
Made a lot of sense, right?
Right.
Try to get them high up.
Sure.
Here's another solution, and tell me if this would work.
Okay.
In your opinion.
All right.
So let's say that you get a giant, I mean really big, thick piece of plastic, almost like something that you would use to, for construction maybe.
Uh-huh.
Very, very thick plastic. Doesn't matter if it's clear, dark plastic, whatever. Just very, very thick. A lot thicker than a garbage bag or something like that,
okay.
Right? And you put that on the ground in your garage, and you drove onto it. So all four wheels are on that plastic. And then you simply took the corners of that plastic and bunched it up almost like a bag, like you put your car in a bag. And as long as all sides of that plastic are up high, you know, you secure them. If you attach them to the rafters up above, or if you just simply tied it at the top with a rope, or if you were if you weren't worried about, you know, floodwaters getting up to the top of the door. If you just tucked it into the door openings, I guess, or the window openings even, if you were only worried about, you know, 1 or 2 feet of water. But what if you were to attach the corners of that plastic to the, I think the best scenario might be attaching them to the rafters in your garage.
Mm-hmm.
So your car is essentially in this big, thick plastic bag. Water should not be able to get to that, right? Floodwaters that slowly rises up. I mean, it would move and compress, and I'm sure that you'd have to deal with the air that's trying to escape that bag.
Right.
As it compressed around it. But wouldn't that work?
I think it's a great start to a fantastic idea. So remember how we had talked about in Detroit, how Ford had sealed up in plastic.
Yeah.
Some of their old models.
Was it Ford? I can't remember who. But there was a warehouse full of vehicles.
It's a warehouse.
Yeah.
Was it Ford or was it GM?
I don't remember, but it was a smart idea.
It might have been GM.
It was at a fort, I think.
Yeah.
Wasn't there was a warehouse at a fort, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have
to dig through. That's a deep cut.
It's a vague memory, but they had them in
shells, essentially.
Yeah, they were plastic, but they were inflated with fans, right?
Yeah.
So that nothing was able to touch them. The plastic wasn't touching the bodies.
Right. And they were kept this way successfully for a long time.
Decades.
Yeah. So I think, the fan might be getting a bit fancy for the average car owner.
Yeah.
But what I would be concerned with is having the opening at the top just sealing off. I understand the engineering necessity to allow venting of air.
Mm-hmm.
But my concern would be the standing water in an enclosed space, because if it's essentially just protecting the car, but the garage is already filled halfway with water and the water's not going anywhere, then I can easily see that compromising the plastic by splashing over it when someone comes through and like maybe even evaporating and condensating back onto it. So I would say it's a fantastic idea, and the way to make it – tell me what you think about this, ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors. I would argue that it should be completely sealed. If there's a way to do it, and I'm still trying to think, because there should be some sort of venting mechanism, maybe at the very top, you know?
Yeah. That's an opening, though.
Yeah, because water is so heavy.
How about this? Okay, so we're just spitballing this back and forth.
Yeah, what if there's a one-way vent?
What if, you know those the machines you can use to vacuum pack food or whatever?
Yeah.
What if you – I mean, even if it was a small thing, and it might take you half an hour to do it, but what if you could – what if there was a kit that you could buy that had this plastic, a bag that you could drive onto, and then something like a thermal device that would seal the edges – and then at the top, you left an opening, a certain amount, and then attach it to like a blower that works in reverse. It just pulls air out, right? So, or even your leaf blower.
Just engineered to be a one-way vent. Okay, this is too good. Shut your mouth. We can't go on because this is going to be our big idea.
So if you vacuum pack your car in a giant plastic bag in your garage.
It sounds ridiculous, but if we can make it affordable,
it really could work.
If we can make it a system for like less than, what do you think, less than $400?
Well, I would think that 500,000 people now would buy that in the Houston area because they know the value of something like that.
Scott, listen, with your ability to create these astonishing, amazing ideas and my inability to feel bad about exploiting these ideas, there's nothing that can stop us, buddy. Straight to the top.
I actually think that's a good idea. All right,
I think it's a great idea.
All right. So you heard of here first, Car Stuff.
Car Stuff.
Trademark. Registered trademark. Whatever it takes.
It is your idea. I asked for no more than 30%.
All right. So let's move on then. So, and I like the listener's opinion on if that would work or not, or if they have a better idea.
Yeah,
or,
I'd like to hear
or
what you guys
variation on that might work. All right. So here's the surprise, and we'll keep this a little bit brief, but I know we're wrapping up. Tesla plays into this. And this is particularly with the Irma evacuation. At least I read about it for the Irma victims, or the potential Irma victims. So let's just say that you're in Florida and you've got a Tesla Model S or Model X, and we all know that there is a limited range on these vehicles.
Oh, so I think I know what you're going to talk about.
Yeah, okay. You probably already have read about this then.
Maybe.
All right. So, you know, you're limited to – I can't remember the distance on it, but I want to say it's like 240 miles or something like that, you know, Model S, typical. Uh-huh. I think there's a little bit more here and there. Or a little bit less in some cases. So here's the thing. When Tesla realized that there were a lot of Tesla Model S and X vehicles that were trying to flee Florida, they did something very nice. The automaker remotely unlocked the full battery capacity of Model S and X 60 and 60D vehicles, giving them the power of the 75 kilowatt hour battery packs. So they gave them full capability. This opened up my eyes to something that I had no idea Tesla was really doing, though. So when you buy a new car, typically you get the full capability of that car, right? You get everything that's available in the vehicle. When you buy a Model S or X, either the 60 or 60D model, you are presented with a series of options when you buy. Now, among those are the distance that the batteries can take you. So there's arbitrary distances put in place so that Tesla can then create price tiers on its cars despite identical hardware inside. So you've got the exact same battery as somebody who has the 75 kilowatt hour battery in a 60 – and I'm putting air quotes around this – in a 60 or 60D vehicle.
You know, I think that's just ridiculous.
I kind of do too. Now, of course, the 60 and 60D vehicles are offered at a lower price range. They are, in fact, the least expensive. But here's the thing was when you buy it, you're able to add on. So you can opt to have the full battery power at 75 kilowatt hours, right? And that's a greater range. And I think it costs something like $6,500 to unlock that extra 15 kilowatt hours on a battery. Versus if you make the purchase and then later you decide to want to add that on, it's $10,000 extra.
So has somebody found a way to just jailbreak it themselves?
No, you can't do that. The company controls it. So what Tesla essentially did was when they realized that all these people were fleeing Florida and they may not have the range that they needed to get to the next gas station – they flipped a switch and gave them an additional, what is it, like 40 miles, I think, is what this gave them, an additional 40 miles on their range. And again, that's something that would have cost them between $6,500 and $10,000. Gave them to them for free, really. Now, I don't know if they're going to take it away from them. They might. But anyways, I thought that was interesting that, you know, you don't get the full capability of a Tesla Model S 60 when you buy it. Unless you purchase the additional battery power.
So from Tesla's perspective, they've argued that software limitations on their vehicles, by which you and I are defining it as, you know, keeping the vehicle from doing mechanically what it is capable of doing through the use of programming, they argue that they are limiting performance in order to increase durability or safety. But to me, with all due respect, Scott, that just sounds like a really sketchy thing to do. It kind of reminds me of a thing that video games do. A lot of video game companies are into the idea of what they call downloadable content, or DLC. Mm-hmm. And some of them have been taking heat, not enough for them to stop the practice, mind you, but some of them have been taking heat for doing things like releasing a game and it's on a disc, right? And the entirety of everything you can do in this game is on the disc. However, to unlock it, you have to pay an additional, you know, $10 or $20, what have you, to be able to play what you had already physically paid for.
Oh man. See, now I hope I was describing this right. I think you've got it, Ben. That's a perfect example for gamers or anybody that doesn't own a Tesla to understand what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Is that the company is putting itself between the owner and the car.
That's a good way to say it.
That's customization, I guess. I mean, really, you can't really customize it the way that you normally would in another type of vehicle. You have to go to the company to say, yes, I want this additional power. I want this additional range. So it's kind of it's really messing with the way people see the relationship between them and their vehicle. I mean, because mm-hmm. the company is squarely in between the two. In fact, so much so that the 60 and 60D models were discontinued. The California-based company decided that clients simply preferred to buy their car's full capability. So, you know, why buy a Model S 60 or a 60D and then, you know, realize that it costs you an additional amount of money to get up to, you know, the optimal battery power, which is already in the car. I mean, it's like it's there. They just have to flip a switch to unlock it. That's not like when you're opting to buy a different engine in a car, or you're opting for, you know, a different transmission or something that provides better performance. Yeah. You know, whether that's gearing or, you know, whatever it happens to be. It's a different model. It's a completely different model for Tesla. And I know that's kind of their thing, mm-hmm. but it's a strange way to look at ownership of these things. I mean, it's interesting to think that they're in between the car and the owner, as far as what they're able to do to kind of soup it up, to fix it up.
And who knows? Maybe that will be the wave of the future. Perhaps it's even inevitable at this point. Perhaps we've reached what Malcolm Gladwell would refer to as a tipping point. What do you think? We want to hear from you. And we hope, I guess most importantly, we hope that anyone who is hearing this and has been affected by Hurricanes Harvey or Irma are safe. You're in a safe place, and we hope your family is doing all right. If you're listening to this episode and you are wondering how you can help, there are innumerable charities that are active in the area. If you live nearby, you can volunteer to distribute food. You can help assemble care packages. The Red Cross is there as well. Both in Texas and, as we record, in Florida.
Seems like every time you turn on the radio or television, you find a place that, you know, if you text a certain number to this place, you'll donate $10 immediately to either Hurricane Irma or Harvey, or maybe even both if you're feeling generous that day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So please do keep those people in your thoughts, and, every little bit helps. Also, as we said earlier, do you have any flood damaged car war stories? We'd like to hear them.
Oh yeah, the ones where you inadvertently bought a car that you know, was in a flood. Not that you know what? Maybe also if you bought a salvage car thinking that it was a good choice.
And if you ever sold someone a flood damaged car, you dirty rascal, you.
Oh boy, I don't know if we want to hear those stories. I feel like I'd feel a little dirty after that.
I just wanted to say dirty rascal. I don't know. I'm kind of freestyling at this point. So please do write to us. Let us know if you are in the market for a car again in the wake of these hurricanes, this hurricane season, please do check out our podcast, 10 Ways to Spot a Flood Damaged Car, before you buy any used vehicle, even if the title looks okay, even if you trust whomever's selling it. Like Ronald Reagan said, trust but verify. We will be back next week with something probably completely different. Let's see, I'm remembering our schedule. But in the meantime, if you would like more Car Stuff, you can find every episode we've ever done on our website, carstuffshow.com. And you can spot Scott and I regularly on Twitter and on Facebook, where we are Car Stuff HSW. Hey, Scott, you might be saying, hey, Ben, I've got a great idea that my fellow listeners will enjoy, but I don't really go in for all that social media hoopla and shenaniganery. Which is a word I just made up.
It's a good word.
It's okay. It's not my best. The point being that we totally get it. You can email us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.